Call the next case. No, Mr. Scarborough, I forgot that you're about to change chairs. I wanted to thank you. You were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance. Thank you. And to your law firm.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Shelley. Here is the court-appointed amicus on behalf of the petitioner, Antoine Jones. Since our threshold issue is the same as in the previous case, I'd like to pick up on a couple of the points that were raised and debated in the prior argument. The mandamus petition in our case, I believe, is a continuation, essentially, of the civil action below. It's not its own action, it's not an appeal, but it's a continuation, it's a correction, really, of the civil action below. In the normal case, there are two PLRA events. First one is the commencement of the civil action in the district court. If all goes as it should and justice proceeds as it should, it comes to a final judgment.
How does that help you, saying it's a continuation?
Because in the sense that it's a correction of the civil action for which the PLRA filing fee has already been paid.
Well, that's true of an appeal, too.
But it's not a, it's appeal, an appeal of a judgment.
Appeal seeks to correct something that occurred below. What's the difference?
Just to finish the point. The point is that the mandamus petition is designed to correct to smooth out the justice below that didn't occur, that basically didn't allow the case, in our case, for instance, to get to a final appealable judgment. And in that instance, you'd have then the second PLRA event, the appeal. What it does is to then treat it as a third event. You'd have a third event in the average mandamus case then. You'd have the civil action at the beginning, you'd have the mandamus event, and then you'd have the appeal.
I mean, what you say is undoubtedly true, but you have perfectly ordinary cases where the district court does something, there's an appeal, we reverse, the district court does something again, there's appeal, we reverse. So, I mean, even without going into the question of interlocutory appeals, there are, sadly, cases that seem to require endless filing of appeals, and they're subject to exactly the objection you make here to the mandamus.
I think that's because the statute says there are civil actions and there are appeals of judgments. And in each of those cases, there's an appeal of a judgment. Now, you may reverse the judgment and cause the civil action to start up again and get to another judgment. But in a case like this, there's no appeal of a judgment here. The goal is not, through the mandamus petition, to actually review on the merits of the judgment below. It's to get the notice of appeal filed so that could occur in our particular case. You had asked Judge Williams a question about the Cohen doctrine and the collateral order doctrine. I think you can treat it the same way, that those types of interlocutory appeals are designed to fix something that's going on in the course of the proceeding. But you don't have to treat it the same. It's a little harder case, I think, than ours, because there really is no right to appeal. In the Cohen case, you can appeal at the end. Our case...
You can, but the grounds for Cohen kick in only when appeal at the end would not be adequate.
Well, it wouldn't be as meaningful.
That's a requirement.
Well,
for
it could
Cohen.
Be what the death knell, sometimes we call it. That certainly suggests it's not adequate.
Well, let's take a qualified immunity situation, for instance, which does come up on a collateral order doctrine. At the end of the case, you could appeal a denial of qualified immunity that was erroneous, for instance. Now, you would avoid liability if you're correct. You would have still had to litigate the whole case below, and you wouldn't have gotten that benefit. But I think a mandamus situation is different because, by definition, it's an extraordinary situation for which there's no other legal relief available by appeal or anything else. But I do think you can treat the Cohen case, the Cohen type of situation, as like mandamus. And I think you can treat the certiorari case like mandamus, too, to go to Judge Randolph's question. I'm not aware that the Supreme Court has ever applied the PLRA to its informa pauperis. It has two rules, Rule 38 says you have to pay a $300 filing fee, and the Supreme Court rules. Rule 39 says, lays out in form of pauperis. And there's no indication that a prisoner has any different rights for informed pauperis as anything else. And regularly, the Supreme Court on Monday mornings issues its orders, and, yeah, and there are all the informed pauperis grants. So I think now if it were a Voting Rights Act case or a Redistricting Act case that comes up on appeal and a prisoner was involved there, that might be different. But I don't think the Supreme Court has treated their cert petitions as covered by the PLRA.
I wondered about that because there's so many of the IFP cases that have traditionally been, the denials on the first Monday in October, or, three-quarters of them are IFP. But let me ask, I'm a little bit confused about the posture of your case. This is a regular civil action. He sought damages or whatever, and it was dismissed because of Heck versus Humphrey.
Correct.
And then he files eight months go by, and he doesn't file a notice of appeal. So he's out of time. He files a motion to allow me to file a notice of appeal, right? And now what happens to that motion?
The judge did not, just writes on the top, leave denied.
That was Judge Leon. Right?
Judge Leon, yes.
Okay, leave denied. And then what?
He does appeal that. He does come here on that.
Then he appeals the denial of the motion for leave to file an appeal.
Correct.
Right? And we say, well, that's mandamus, right? And then an order comes out and says you have to pay $450. Is that
in this court?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If that were true,
he's not in form of pauperis status.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, and the court didn't make him pay the $450 as a result.
Didn't.
Did not, because they're trying to figure out here whether to pay
IFP.
Or not.
I'm just wondering if he had to pay $450. To seek mandamus of his motion to allow him to file a notice of appeal, and then if that were granted, would he have to pay another $450 for the appeal?
He would. He would.
$900 for the.
If that's the case, because reality, if you grant the mandamus petition, what you'll be saying is that the district court should have allowed the appeal, should have filed it as a notice of appeal, and proceedings should now occur on appeal here. Well, his appeal would have to be docketed. He'd have to pay the $450 fee.
But we're not back to – we're now back in the way this came to rest, though, is back to square one. The only question is whether he can file a notice – he never called this mandamus.
He did not call it a notice of appeal.
What?
He called what he filed here a notice of appeal. He filed it in the Court of Appeals. One way to look at this case is...
One way to look at it is he wants to file a notice of appeal out of time. Period. Now, if we look at it that way, what's your argument for why he doesn't have to pay the $450?
If he wants to file the notice of appeal, he has to pay the filing fee if this is going to be treated as an appeal. But he can't get here on an appeal because he doesn't have a notice of appeal that's ever been docketed anywhere. It's sort of a simple procedural issue for him. It is basically
simple to me.
Well, I don't mean simple. It's a technical one. It's a very technical case in the sense that he seeks to appeal. The district court didn't allow it, and he thinks the district court erred in not allowing it, and he wants that notice of appeal filed so that he can bring the merits of the judgment below up here. And if you were to grant the mandamus petition, you'd simply be putting him in the posture of a normal appeal, though the government could then move to dismiss it as out of time.
Right.
But he would have to pay two filing fees if you hold that his mandamus petition is subject to the filing fee.
Can I ask, I have also a complication about this. So assume for the moment he didn't put the words motion in front of it, and he just filed a notice of appeal. Why isn't that the end? Why don't we therefore have an appeal? That is, yes, the district court said he couldn't, and yes, the district court clerk didn't docket it, but why does that make any difference? The rule says that an appeal is permitted by filing a notice with the district clerk. And the Rule 5 says a paper is filed by delivering it to the clerk. The clerk doesn't have any authority to not accept it. The court doesn't have any authority to not accept it. If it doesn't show up on our docket, It's not a ground for not allowing an appeal.
I think, Judge Garland, you're correct.
So you don't need to
mandamus.
We didn't need to mandamus this. You didn't need. The problem here is that it was submitted to the court as a motion rather than as an appeal.
He styled it incorrectly. The title was wrong. The rest of it was just a notice of appeal.
But then he corrected that later, didn't he?
No.
I thought he actually filed a notice of appeal later.
Well, he filed a motion for leave to file a notice of appeal. That's the title of it in the district court. But it's really just a notice of appeal. There's nothing in there, really, other than saying, you got this thing wrong, and I want to go up to the Court of Appeals. Then about a month later, the judge wrote on the top, leave denied. And a short time later, Mr. Jones appealed here. He filed a notice of appeal. The thing entitled notice of appeal
so
is here. And he attaches all those other documents.
If you win, then your client loses $450.
If we win on the mandamus petition, he gets an appeal. He gets an appeal that.
And if he gets an appeal, he does.
You don't want him to have to pay twice, I take it.
Exactly. There's an alternative way to look at this case, though, which is the supplemental brief we filed, which is that his motion to the district court for leave to file an appeal could be deemed a motion for reconsideration of the final judgment in the first place. He did timely file a notice of appeal here of that denial of the Rule 60B motion, if you treat that as a Rule 60B motion, and then he would have a full appeal here on the question of whether the district court abused its discretion in denying the 60B, and I think he'd win that if he could pay the filing fee, because the district court was plainly wrong under Heck. The government never defends the Heck ruling in the first place, and you can get relief under 60B if a legal judgment is clearly erroneous, and it clearly was here.
Well, could he file again if... I understand what you're saying about Hecht, but so the district court rules Hecht bars this, but now Hecht doesn't bar it anymore. Can he file another habeas? Or the problem is that we're getting...
Habeas,
another civil rights suit.
Well, he probably could file a new civil rights suit, but now he's got three strikes against him, conceivably, one of them which is in this lawsuit, which he shouldn't have because
he's
actually correct.
The government says it's a strike. No one's determined that it's
that's
a
true.
Strike.
The government, that's true. Well, he'd have to go back and try to... You'd have to treat this case as one that's been nullified, essentially, because of the overturning of his conviction. Mm-hmm. But he could go back and file a new civil rights lawsuit. He could also conceivably go back and file a 60B motion with the district court, assuming the district court has jurisdiction, it probably would if this is a mandamus proceeding as opposed to an appeal, but if it's an appeal, the district court probably wouldn't have jurisdiction. But he could go back there with a Rule 60B motion, and the only question would be whether it's timely. And he probably is not. I don't know if it would be deemed timely by the district court. But to get to the end of Judge Randall's question, I think the answer is yes. If he wins on the mandamus petition, he gets an appeal. He gets to proceed with an appeal that the government could move to dismiss as untimely, or we could argue alternatively it's not untimely.
He gets to pay $450.
Or he gets to pay $450 either through the installment payment plan under the PLRA or up front if he were determined to have three strikes. So, thank you.
May it please the Court, Alexander Shoaibi again for the appellee. What appellant points out here at the beginning is the point that I was making earlier, particularly in this case. What this is essentially is an appeal that should be covered under the PLRA.
Yeah, but you're making it two appeals, right?
Well, under any circumstance, however, based on the division of criminal and civil in the statute, this is clearly civil and clearly should be covered under the PLRA if it is going to be, if it's a civil action or an appeal. And it is, in essence, an appeal from a civil action.
He's not trying to get around the need to appeal by calling it mandamus. I mean, that's not the problem in this case, right?
True.
I mean, this only gives him two fees to pay, not one. He'd be happy to call this an appeal. Are you happy to call this an appeal too, then?
Well, I don't think I can because he was late.
No, that's a different question. That's up to us to decide whether he was late. And if it's considered an appeal, you file a motion saying it's out of time, and we determine whether that's true or not. But that doesn't affect the question of whether it is an appeal.
I would have to... I guess the word is concede. I mean, I think it was an appeal. I think it was an attempt to appeal a case. But I don't think that under any circumstances, be it called a mandamus or a civil action or appeal, does he get around the filing fee of the PLRA.
What happens if somebody files a notice of appeal in the district court and the clerk of the district court simply declines to docket it or declines to send a copy to the Court of Appeals? What happens then?
I think that's what happened here. I think it was.
Yes, I understand, but it is.
I'm sorry. That's got to be smug.
Do we have to mandamus the clerk, or can we just go right ahead?
Not pro tunc.
I think the mandamus approach was probably a defensible one here. I mean, I think it did what they thought was correct in that circumstance, and it sounds like it's probably the right approach. With regard to the merits of the case, I think that under any circumstances, Grant's filing was late. It was 8 months late. He went past any possible time limitation under any of the rules of this court.
What if the prison simply refused to deliver it to him? Can prisons prevent prisoners from litigating a case by simply delaying notice to them of a court result? I'm not saying that did happen in this case, but that's the hypothetical problem.
Right.
Can they simply make every single prisoner out of time by just not delivering notices? The Supreme Court's already held that from the other point of view, from the mailing, all you have to do is deliver, the prisoner has to do is deliver it to the prisoner. Prison can't just stand in the way.
I think if there were, again, I almost feel like I'm playing judge here. I think if I were applying Houston v. Lack, I think it would be potentially, you could make
that
parallel.
I think it works both ways.
I think it might.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine that it wouldn't. But there's no evidence of that in this case here.
If we consolidated sua sponte, his seeking review of the clerk's failure to docket the notice of appeal with the appeal itself, okay, on the merits, we consolidate them, would he have to pay $900 or $450? Why don't we just do that? Why don't we just do that and get rid of this case?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think you could probably.
Would you object to that? Wait. Would you object to that?
Since it doesn't affect. Well.
What would your objection be?
And you're talking about docketing the appeal, not a decision as to whether or not the appeal is.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't think it would be a improper approach. No.
Yeah. All right. Good.
Anything further from me, Your Honor?
No further questions?
Thank you.
I just have one further point to make.
Do you have any objection to that? Consolidated?
Describe it once more, because I'm not sure I quite followed it.
We've got, technically, there's one thing pending, which is the objection to the clerk, the district court clerk's failure to docket the appeal, right? And then there's the notice of the appeal itself. It appears that that's what he intended to file. So what if we just sua sponte consolidate both of those? You know, obviously you would have to decide that the notice, there's a notice of appeal properly filed before you get to the merits of the appeal. But if we consolidated both of them, then, and the government has no objection to doing that, and he wouldn't have to pay $900, he'd only pay $450.
If you said 450,
I hear 500?
I'll take 450. If you say 450, I think it puts him in the situation he legally should be in,
yeah.
Which is that he tried to appeal. He properly told the district court he wanted to appeal, and either he can get the district court judgment on the merits up here on appeal or the Rule 60B idea that I mentioned before. Yeah. Either of those would require $450 from him or the installment payment plan if he doesn't have the strikes, and I think that resolution would be appropriate.
Can I ask you about 1915A also?
No.
Do you think that it does put all cases that require that they be in either the civil or the criminal category in order to be entitled to IFP status in the first place?
Well, I think one answer to that would be that there may be an inherent right in the courts to treat an a proceeding in forma pauperis, whether it's a civil action, criminal action, or if there's this category of something else.
We're interpreting the statute here, not our inherent rights.
Well, what I was saying is that I don't think you have to treat a mandamus petition as a civil action or as a criminal proceeding. It may be this third category of ancillary type of proceedings, like a habeas petition or a cert petition.
But is it not the case that this statute, which is the only one that permits in forma pauperis, seems to require us to put it in one or the other category?
Well, I think in forma pauperis status existed before this statute. And so I think you could take I would take the position that there are some actions potentially that don't fit in that statute, and it's not the exclusive means of informa pauperis status, potentially. But I don't want to necessarily leave that as my only argument. The argument I think you can make is that a mandamus petition is not its own civil action. It is part of the civil action, the first civil action. It's not the appeal of the judgment. It's part of the first civil action for which the filing fee's already been paid in the district court on the installment payment plan. He's just using this as an ancillary proceeding to get the district court to finish that proceeding in the proper way, docket the notice of appeal so that he can then get to the second PLRA event, which is the appeal of the judgment. So if you take the view that that's the exclusive means for informa pauperis status, we would still fit in it for the mandamus petition without having to file a second filing fee because it's part of the civil action for which the filing fee's already been paid.
Any questions? Okay. I want to thank you also. You were also appointed by the court, and the court very much appreciates your help on this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under submission. We'll take a brief recess while the parties...